Good evening, everyone. This is Rochelle Wilhite, the designated broker for Best Choice Realty. We are on the conference call regarding listings, where we're going to go over common mistakes and questions that I receive on a regular basis on some of the listing forms. And a lot of questions have been asked about these forms, when I should use them, which forms get submitted to the MLS, which ones do I have to have on file for the office, which ones would be good in this type of situation or that situation. So hopefully tonight's call, you'll get a better understanding of some of these form numbers that you may have wondered about, how they're utilized, and in what situations you may want to pull them up. And then also get kind of an idea of the process when you're taking a listing, what you will need to provide and get signed by the seller. All right, so let's get started. The first thing, number one, and I reiterate this so many times, but I still see so many agents that do this incorrectly. The moment you're going to take a listing, we've talked about it on other calls, you should contact your title company, whatever title company that you have a relationship with. I have many. If you want to utilize my relationships, I have excellent people that you can refer to if you need a good title rep. But what you need to do is call the title company the moment you know you're going to take a listing or you're going to meet with a seller and order a trio or preliminary title. If in today's market, you almost want to get the prelim started because it does take some time to actually run the title report through the title company. You'll sometimes see those title reports that take maybe a week to get, and that's because they have to check the seller's name, verify things on the title to make sure it is insurable. And so that would be something, if I was going to go on a listing appointment in Bellevue, Kirkland, Seattle, those types of areas that are very, very hot. We actually have hot areas now in Tacoma and even Chehalis. You kind of want to get started on that process right away. So there's no cost to you. It's complimentary. If you know you're going to get the listing, call your title rep and ask to get the preliminary title report started. In the preliminary title report, you know, you should get a copy of the property profile, a copy of the legal description, a copy of the plat map if you request it, and the last vesting deed, which is the most important part of the title report, is the vesting, how it's vested, the names on the title, and who is the seller. So that's the most important part that you need. You need that in order to take a listing, because if you do not have a legal description and it refers to it in the agreement, in essence, you do not have a valid listing agreement. And so you're practicing in a very, very haphazard way, and you know, you risk the chance of having some problems. So make sure that you call your title company as soon as possible and get that ordered up. Then what I do is I take that legal description and I upload that into Transaction Desk when I'm building my potential seller and building the documents that I'm going to need to provide. But you need to ask yourself at this point in the game, do I want to work through Transaction Desk and do everything electronic with my seller? Or do I want to print everything out that I'm going to need and go on the appointment with the seller? I kind of waffle between both situations just because the type of sellers that I deal with. So you want to ask yourself, am I dealing with a seller that's in person that wants to touch and feel the paperwork and know that they have a good agent handling things? Or am I dealing with somebody that's maybe overseas or that is out of the state, it's hard to get a hold of, that I'm probably not going to meet in person? Then you want to use a Transaction Desk and build everything electronically for signature. But in the listing side, it actually is easier to do everything physically, just because the Form 17 is difficult to do on Transaction Desk. So I'd recommend using the forms, printing them out and have them ready to go, or go ahead and use electronic. So tonight I'm going to go over manually how I do it. And then again, if you want some help in making it easy on Transaction Desk, we certainly can help you through that. So the next form I'm going to gather, this is like the number one form, is the worksheet. And I'm going to discuss the Form 1. It's Form 10. It's different forms depending on if you're listing vacant land or a condo or if you're listing a residential. But I'm going to just talk about the Form 1. It's very close to the other ones. This is what we consider the input sheets. These are the sheets that you learned how to fill out electronically or on the MLS when you took the listing input class back in the day, where you can go into the MLS, you can go into the input, and you can actually detail out all of the things that you're going to advertise that belongs to the property, where it's located, when the showings are going to take place, what does it have? Does it have a roof? Does it have, does it have cedar shakes, shingles, or does it have waterfront or views? Those are the types of things that you'd want to detail out on the Form 1. Now, I've been practicing for a long time, and knock on wood, I have not been asked by the MLS or by any entity for a copy of your Form 1s or your input sheets. However, I have been in situations where the input sheets with clients goes a long way. If I have them initial, for example, on the Form 1 at the bottom of every page of the input sheets, then in essence, I have their authority to represent them in all of my inputting that I'm doing on the MLS. So what I like to see if you're doing this manually is print out the input sheets. It's Form 1 for residential. There's like 4 or 5 pages, and it's like a lot of places where there's dots. The part that's mandatory to fill out, it would be on the dots. And do the best you can at filling that whole thing out before you go on the appointment. The reason for that is because when you're at the appointment, you don't want to spend the time going through that form. You want to really go through and ask about the seller's motivation and consult about how you're going to market their property. You're not going to want to spend the time going over every little input detail. So you should have that filled out for the most part, either typed or have it manually filled out with your pen and your handy notepad. And then on the section where it says marketing remarks, you could put to be determined, or you could put some sort of information so that the seller knows that you're going to write those up later. To be emailed to the client, I've seen a lot of agents do that, and that's perfectly fine. The reason for those input sheets, though, is to get validation from the seller, obviously on important points like what appliances are going to stay and which ones they're going to keep or take with them, and obviously the price. Those are the two really, really important points on the input sheets that need to be filled in and really need the seller's okay on that before moving forward. If you didn't have input sheets, it wouldn't be the end of the world because you are, all of you have the authority to go in and input your own listings. What I'd like you to get good at doing, though, if you're going to be using technology and inputting it that way, before it goes live, screen share or copy and paste what the MLS sheet is going to look like when it goes live and send it to your seller and get their okay or their second set of eyes to just say, yes, this looks good, Rochelle, before moving forward. Because it would have the price on there. It would have all of the appliances that were included all on that MLS input sheet in a kind of format that's just like a one-pager that they can review. So what I like to see, best practice again tonight, just a quick review, either the input sheets filled out and initialed by the seller or some sort of email that you've sent to the seller just saying, hey, look over my inputting. Does the price and does everything look okay? Are there any changes that need to be made before we go live on the market? And that can be done very simply. And both situations work nicely with sellers that and listing agents that produce a lot of listings. So that would be what I recommend for Form 1. Then Form 1A, let's go into that. Form 1A is actually the exclusive listing agreement. There are mistakes that are made on this consistently. Number one mistake is that there is no legal description attached. And you do have 3 days to attach it to the MLS now. The legal description is a required document. But a lot of agents are getting their sellers to sign it without having the legal description initialed or attached. So if you're kind of out of practice or out of, maybe you need a better solution on getting that done, like I said, I always upload that or have it printed so I can have the seller initial that when I meet with them. This is your ticket to an actual binding agreement. Really, technically, if you just had a 1A and a legal description attached and you sent that to the office, in essence, you have a listing agreement and you have the authority to act on the seller's behalf and to price and market and put a key box on and get paid a commission for the work and efforts that you're going to put into the listing. So be sure it's filled out correctly and be sure it has a legal description so it is effective when that legal description is attached as Exhibit A. Number one thing I see a lot of people make a mistake on is not having the legal description attached and also not filling out the commission appropriately. And if there are changes on the commission or the list date, If you've crossed things off, it must have an initial by you and by the seller, or at least by the seller. Certainly we could actually, you know, execute it or initial it, but we do need at least the seller's initial on any changes that are made to the commission or to the list date. On the commission, I say this all the time in my classes, but I still see this happening. The commission is the top line is the total commission. It's in parentheses. Total commission. That means that the listing contract is the way that the buyer's agents get paid. So what kind of irks me a bit is when the buyers come to me and say, well, I want to ask, you know, I want some of your commission. You know, different companies are giving me, you know, part of their commission. And I usually like to say to them, that's something that is negotiated with the seller. The seller is the one that pays me the commission and depends on how much the seller is willing to give me. I've often been able to retain my hard-earned commission by explaining how commission is done in the state of Washington. Buyers obtain commission because the sellers are willing to pay the commission, and it's an agreement that's done with this 1A that, in effect, makes it possible for the buyers to get and obtain a commission. Now, certainly, we can offer, you know, to provide some sort of compensation or adjust our commission if we want to. But again, that is all dictates on how we get paid on the total commission through the listing agreement. So make sure that's filled in appropriately and that the buyer's agent commission is on that second line. Okay. And then the undersigned, the sole owners, if you've got a last vesting deed from the title company and it has the names of Jack and Sally on there, and Jack and Sally are the same owners that are on the last vesting deed, then you can certainly check the box yes. I see sometimes that you guys don't check the box. If you have a last vesting deed, that box needs to be checked yes. And then the legal description, which is on the last vesting deed, has the names of the property owners on the deed and, in essence, is the legal description as well. And then you have the seller sign. You are authorized to sign under real estate firm. You can write Best Choice Realty on the firm, and then you sign the broker's signature. It does not need my signature. It just needs to be signed by you. If you fail to sign it, oftentimes what I'll do is I'll go ahead and sign it for you, but it does save me some time in having you go ahead and sign the broker's signature section on page 2. Now, some people have asked me, Rochelle, I want a partner. You know, I see all these teams that are going on. Well, the state of Washington and the MLS are cracking down on the teams right now. So you want to make sure that your seller is appropriately educated on what other entities or what other brokers are going to be helping me in selling or listing my property. This goes for even husband and wife. You know, if the husband's going to be helping out with the wife, we have a few of those teams already within Best Choice. Even if the wife is going to be ultimately the one that's going to be the main point of contact, you are going to want to go ahead and put both names on the agency, dual agency section, on section 2. There is a form now that's new. So let's say that we wanted to partner with John L. Scott or Keller Williams or something like that. We are allowed to do that at Best Choice Realty. In fact, I think it's a great idea to take advantage of both offices and the marketing that we both could do. So if I had a good friend over at Keller Williams and we had a seller that was going to be selling in Redmond, we could, in essence, be on the listing agreement together. However, it doesn't really work to be on the 1A. What we could do is have the 1A be the primary person, and then there's a form 1S that talks about a sub-agent, meaning maybe we have another agent at Keller Williams that we agree to have a sub-agency with. And in that case, we would need a 1S on file if we were going to include that person on the agreement. So we have situations like that where I think have become a little dicey for sellers, and so that 1S was created so that we properly communicate with the seller who is going to be the primary and who is going to be the sub on the listing agreement. So make sure if you're going to partner that you have a 1S or you look at that 1S form. The other form that I'm going to take with me on the appointment would be the Form 17. And the way I like to include the Form 17 is by providing it, printed it out. I don't fill out anything. In fact, I don't even put the address on there. But I tell the seller that I'd like them to spend some time after I leave, after I've taken the listing agreement, I've got their signature, In their folder, I have a copy of the Form 17. I tell them it's their homework that needs to be finished before I come back to get the photography done. That gives them approximately, like, you know, at least the way I run it, a few days, if not a week, to fill out the Form 17 and have it available for me to pick up, or to have them email it if it's easier for them, and scan and email it over to me. That Form 17, I like to have available the moment I go live on the market, because I think a lot of buyers respect the fact the seller has taken the time to fill out the Form 17 and alleviates a lot of countering that goes on, or potential areas of default, meaning that the buyers want to back out, or if the seller forgets to provide it within that five-day period of time. So it's a much, much better practice to have the Form 17 filled out and uploaded as a supplementary document. I would love to see 100% of our listings have Form 17s attached. I think that's best practice. Of course, we can have a healthy debate if you've come from an office where your other broker has advised you otherwise, but I think I can make a good debate and show you how important it is to have a Form 17 attached as a supplementary. So that's how I run Form 17. So I have that done as well. And that technically is really all the forms I need. However, I have never gone wrong by also having a Form 18 in my package. And the reason why I include a Form 18 is for those times when the seller says to me, I don't want to sign this 1A. Can you do an the last broker wanted me to didn't do a good job. She didn't actually do an open house. And, you know, you told me you're going to be doing an ultimate open house. Would you put that in writing, Rochelle? Can you make it clear what you're going to do? Sometimes sellers come up with the weirdest requests, and all you have to do is write that into the contract and honor that, and all of a sudden you've got the listing. So I've never been wrong by having a Form 18. Form 18, in essence, if you've done a lot of transactions, is like a Form 34 on the buyer's side, where it's a blank addendum where you can also negotiate if we need a price reduction after a certain period of time. That Form 18 is a way to communicate with the office about any additional things you're doing, or put in writing something that would be needed in order for you to take the listing. The things I often see is ultimate open house to be scheduled on such and such a date. Seller wishes to receive offers on a certain date. Anything that would be above and beyond the 1A would need to be listed there on the Form 18. If you're going to do a price reduction after being on the market for 2 weeks, that would be on there on the Form 18. If they have a neighbor who said, I'll go ahead and, you know, sign a listing agreement with you, but if the neighbor ends up buying the house, I don't want to pay you a commission, that would need to be on a Form 18. So any type of thing like that that you run into, or that you need some help with language, certainly send me a text or send me an email. I'll happily help you with the Form 18. But treat the Form 18 as like kind of your secret weapon if you need to use it. I mean, even if I just check the box and say, you know, Best Choice Realty will be providing an ultimate open house at no cost to the seller. Sellers love that. And I've put that into the contract to kind of win out over my competition. Or maybe I'm providing staging, you know, which is above and beyond for the same 6% commission. I'm providing staging for my seller. That also I've seen on a Form 18. So those types of things that are not typical, or that are costs that you're going to incur, things like that would be on a Form 18. But don't go crazy. Think of Form 18 like Form 34. It also could be very, very detrimental to your business, or create a lot of chaos or confusion, and we want to avoid that at all costs. So for the most part, 1A legal description, and like I said, you may have a Form 18. A lot of agents have asked me about the Form 7s. You know, do I use those? What supplementary things do you do for your listings, Rochelle? And so I like to go over these briefly. There are many. I only use, or I've used three in my career. I always use the 7B, 7B as in boy, because I like to control I don't like to have to input the seller's phone number. I don't want to have any room for a buyer's agent to try to solicit my seller. I've had situations where I've done a lot of work with sellers, and you know, for whatever reason, I took a listing for a month or two because I'm honoring their request. And then after I have to cancel something out, then all of the, what I call the leeches, they go after my sellers and try to take the listing from me, poach it. And I don't like them doing that. And so for me, I always use a 7B, and I exempt the seller from providing their phone number. I've never had a seller question me on this. I've always told them, you know, would you like me to handle the showings and making sure that any questions that are directed about offers and about your property come through me? And they love that because they don't want to be stressed about having to say something that they'll regret. So I do a 7B on every listing for the most part, unless the seller is okay with having their phone number and okay with, you know, having it set up that way on the MLS. Otherwise, you have to send the if you zero out the phone number on the owner phone section in the MLS, then the Northwest MLS requires you to have a 7B on file. So when I do a 7B, I have to have it filled out, put the seller's phone number on that section, have the seller sign it, and then I have to submit the 7B to the MLS. And I submit it to listinginput@nwmls.com, and then the MLS goes ahead and authorizes or puts a note on the listing that that is okay. Otherwise, it would be a violation, and you have only a day or two to correct it, I believe. So make sure that you, if you are going to let them have the phone number, that you put the phone number on there. The owner's phone number cannot be your phone number unless you are the owner. And if you don't want to have it disclosed, simply fill out the 7B and send it to the MLS, and you are not obligated to put the phone number on the MLS. 7I I have used in my past as well. And 7I is when showings are restricted. Now, this is not recommended, but if I have a really particular seller, I'm picturing somebody that has probably a luxury home, and they are not wanting to have all of these people coming at the same time. This is a form that restricts the sellers or restricts the selling agents from showing concurrently. So I have used it for that, and I also have maybe they have a death in the family that's occurred, or something happened where they do not need showings, you know, which maybe is a more, you know, like a day or two. They need the time over the weekend to mourn or to go through some things where they want the showings temporarily suspended. This is the form that you would send to the MLS to have that suspended or to limit the concurrent showing. So I have used this in the past for, you know, some of the luxury listings that I've done, or in situations where things got chaotic or the sellers had some family matters to deal with. And in that case, we went ahead and used a 7I, submitted it to the MLS, and that limited the amount of buyers that were coming through, and it gave us time to recoup. So think about that when you're using those types of addendums. The Form 7s are kind of outside the box, not typical, but, you know, may want to have at least the 7B that you use on a regular basis. But beyond that, you know, it's very rare that you use a 7I or a 7U. 7U would be if there's an unpublished listing, meaning they don't want to put it on the MLS and syndicate it out to the all the world. Maybe they just want you to find them a buyer and notify your friends in the business. And so that's an unpublished listing in 7U if they want that. So you have to have that on file if it's not listed on the MLS. So a 7U is required for that. Or if they're not wanting their address disclosed out there. And that would be a very rare occurrence. But I have had, and there was a guy in my, another designated broker I knew that he says he's got a seller who's really particular, does not want her listing on, you know, Redfin and on Zillow and some of these other third-party sites. And she's wants to have this agent market the property for her and find her a buyer, but does not want it on the MLS and does not want it on all these websites. And if that's the case, you can still take a 1A, but you need to have a 7U and submit that to the MLS as well so that they know it's unpublished. Okay, so those are the only three, 7B, 7I, 7U, that I've used. The other one, 7A, is I don't recommend. It's making the listing firm present for every showing. I don't recommend that practice. 7E, selling firm share of commission. Don't want you to use that. You know, that's not something I want you to get practice of just using the commission rates that we have already talked about in class. And then 7F and 7G, those are not used very often. In fact, I would not want to encourage you to use those. And 7G, third-party fee, that would be used if you're representing short sale. So some of you guys have experience in using 7G. We don't use that very often anymore. And a lot of people ask me that have had lending experience, Rochelle, can I go ahead and make the 7H? Can they be approved by an identified lender? I wouldn't limit the amount of buyers that you get, but you certainly may want to consider doing that. If you have a really good relationship with a lender and you want to maybe can encourage them to use, you know, or get a second app taken with that lender, you would need a 7H on file. But I don't think I would encourage you to do so. So those 7A, E, F, G, and H are not recommended, but there are certain cases where we have used them. It's very rare. Okay? And the last thing I wanted to talk about would be the supplementary documents on things that you should consider if you're the listing agent that you may gather when you're there with the seller and meeting with the seller, and some things that you may want to ask them for to provide so that you can properly disclose some of the good things that your seller has done. So some of the things I love to see in the supplementary docs, one of the things I think was really, really awesome is when a seller will take the time, especially if they've done a lot of work to the property, and list out, because there's not enough room on the MLS, as we know, to list out all of the upgrades. You know, it's a 42 BTU. I'm making all this stuff up tonight. But if there's a special water tank that they use for their water heater, if there's, you know, they put in the Shaw carpet, you know, that was upgraded with an 8-pound pad, almost think of it like a builder. You know, if they've done a lot of updating to the property and they want to basically give that document to the potential buyers, you could have the seller list the updates in a supplementary document and provide that to the buyer. That makes the buyer feel like, wow, I'm getting a really, really good deal. I've got all of this, you know, I've got this house, but also the seller's provided all these supplementary things that come with the house. So that's an idea that has worked really well, and that could be listed as a supplementary document. Other things I've gathered from seller, which actually enhances my listing, would be like receipts. So if my seller has pumped their septic tank in the last 12 months, I'm going to want to get a copy of that receipt and also attach that as a supplementary doc, because that's a required thing that every county is going to require, is some sort of septic pumping. And if the seller has already done that within the 12 months, then that gives the seller or gives the buyer comfort that our seller is forthcoming with information, that it checks out, and it also is just one step further to getting to the close. So I recommend if you are working with a seller and they have done that, to provide them to get a copy of that receipt. Also, well documents, well logs, well certificates, anything that relates to the well or the septic in terms of receipts, go ahead and get that. If the seller has done a roof replacement, I think it certainly helps to have that receipt on file, so showing that the roof was replaced in a certain period of time. Anything that would be supplementary as far as things that they disclosed in their Form 17, maybe they had their windows, they had a Milgard come out and replace several windows that were damaged, and so there's a copy of that receipt or that warranty. If there's a warranty on the windows, that might be a good supplementary doc to have attached as well. So anything that goes with the house, supplementary. I mean, you can go crazy with this. Don't go super crazy, but I mean, I'm giving you the maximum things that I've done before that really have helped the buyer, you know, see themselves living into a property that is full disclosure, where sellers have provided information to help them make a good decision. And that definitely adds to their Form 17 as well. Also attach the Form 17. We talked about that. Also attach the legal. And when you're working with condominiums, I've seen people attach the resale certificate, which is very helpful, because especially in a multiple offer situation, if you already have a copy of the resale certificate, I often can waive the resale certificate review date if you have a copy of that, and also copy of CC&Rs. Sometimes the file is too large, I found, but for the most part, I could break it up into parts and attach it, or you know, downsize the file. But having the CCNRs ready to click on from the MLS makes it really easy as well. Title supplement, if the title, you've got a full title report. I've seen that attached to supplementary. But I've heard a lot of buyer's agents complain, I wish the seller or the listing agent would label the supplementary documents. So if you could just do us one little quick, you know, help there and label the documents when you attach them as supplementary, that would be a very big help, because we're working with the documents in Transaction Desk, and if you don't label them, sometimes they just say supplement. They don't say anything more. So if you could help us with that, that would be awesome. And that's all that we have tonight. So hopefully you got some good tips. As you can tell, there's not as many forms for the listing side. Don't forget that you do need to provide the Law of Agency pamphlet and the lead-based paint pamphlet if it's built prior to 1978. If you want to go ahead and get started and have the supplementary, the 22K and the 22J as supplementary documents, and fill them out according to what the seller, you know, has told you as far as, you know, what they know about lead-based paint and what the utility companies are for that particular property, that goes a long way. It shows that you've done your due diligence and you've gathered that information from the seller. So don't be shy about those pamphlets and giving those pamphlets and providing those supplementary documents to the buyer's agents on the MLS. And, of course, if you have questions, you certainly can call me or text or email me if you have questions. But this is the time of the year to take as many listings as you possibly can. I get asked this question pretty much wherever I go. If I go to a dinner party on Sunday, or if I was at my little girl's performance on Saturday, you know, people are asking me because they know I'm in the business, Rochelle, what do you think about this market? Isn't it crazy? And I always say yes. And I always tell them, you know, if I had a home to sell right now, this would be the time to really get it on the market and get it listed. And they're like, really? You think so? And I'm like, absolutely. The market is really, really good right now for sellers. So if you're thinking about selling, we may want to run the numbers and see where you sit and find out if it makes sense for you to get it on the market and get it sold. And so, you know, certainly have those conversations. The more conversations you have with your sellers, the more listings you'll take and the more money you'll make, because right now it is a seller's market just about in every county. All right, you guys have a great week. Enjoy the sunshine and have a successful day and evening. And like I said, we'll catch you next week. We're going to be covering another important topic of receiving offers next Monday, on how we deal with multiple offers and how you look at the offers when they come in from a seller's perspective. Maybe some potential ways to counter. A lot of you guys need some help on doing that. You're not countering well enough or educating the seller well enough on some of the terms that are really important to them to have a successful close. And there are deals that are falling apart with sellers, and there are reasons for that and ways to prevent that. So we'll cover that next week. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you soon.